Chapter 13. Sleep would not come. It was not because I was proud of my travels, and excited about having been around the big world to China, and feeling contemptuous of Bartle Sperling, the traveler, as he called himself, and looked down upon us others, because he had been to Vienna once, and was the only Iseldorf boy who had made such a journey, and seen the world's wonders. At another time, that would have kept me awake, but it did not affect me now. No, my mind was filled with Nicholas, my thoughts ran upon him only, and the good days we had seen together at romps and frolics in the woods, and the fields and the river in the long summer days, and skating and sliding in the winter, when our parents thought we were in school. And now he was going out of this young life, and the summers and winters would come and go, and we others would rove, and play as before, but his place would be vacant, we should see him no more. To Dashmoro he would not suspect, but would be as he had always been, and it would shock me to hear him laugh, and see him do lightsome and frivolous things, for to me, he would be a corpse, with waxen hands and dull eyes, and I should see the shroud around his face. And next day he would not suspect, nor the next, and all the time his handful of days would be wasting swiftly away, and that awful thing coming nearer and nearer, his fate closing steadily around him, and no one knowing it, but Seppi and me. 12 days, only 12 days. It was awful to think of. I noticed that in my thoughts I was not calling him by his familiar names, Nick and Nicky, but was speaking of him by his full name, and reverently, as one speaks of the dead. Also, as incident after incident of our comradeship came thronging into my mind out of the past, I noticed that they were mainly cases where I had wronged him or hurt him, and they rebuked me and reproached me, and my heart was wrung with remorse. Just as it is when we remember our unkindnesses to friends who have passed beyond the veil, and we wish we could have them back again, if only for a moment, so that we could go on our knees to them and say, have pity, and forgive. Once when we were 9 years old he went a long errand of nearly 2 miles for the fruiterer, who gave him a splendid big apple for reward, and he was flying home with it, almost beside himself with astonishment and delight, and I met him, and he let me look at the apple, not thinking of treachery, and I ran off with it, eating it as I ran, he following me and begging, and when he overtook me, I offered him the core, which was all that was left, and I laughed. Then he turned away, crying, and said he had meant to give it to his little sister. That smote me, for she was slowly getting well of a sickness, and it would have been a proud moment for him, to see her joy and surprise, and have her caresses. But I was ashamed to say I was ashamed, and only said something rude and mean, to pretend I did not care, and he made no reply in words, but there was a wounded look in his face as he turned away toward his home which rose before me many times in after years, in the night, and reproached me, and made me ashamed again. It had grown dim in my mind, by and by, then it disappeared. But it was back now, and not dim. Once at school, when we were 11, I upset my ink and spoiled 4 copy books, and was in danger of severe punishment. But I put it upon him, and he got the whipping. And only last year I had cheated him in a trade, giving him a large fish hook which was partly broken through for 3 small sound ones. The first fish he caught broke the hook, but he did not know I was blamable, and he refused to take back one of the small hooks which my conscience forced me to offer him, but said, "A trade is a trade. The hook was bad, but that was not your fault." No, I could not sleep. These little, shabby wrongs upbraided me and tortured me, and with a pain much sharper than one feels when the wrongs have been done to the living. Nicholas was living, but no matter, he was to me as one already dead. The wind was still moaning about the eaves, the rain still pattering upon the panes. In the morning I sought out Seppi and told him. It was down by the river. His lips moved, but he did not say anything. He only looked dazed and stunned, and his face turned very white. He stood like that a few moments, the tears welling into his eyes. Then he turned away, and I locked my arm in his and we walked along thinking, but not speaking. We crossed the bridge and wandered through the meadows, and up among the hills and the woods, and at last the talk came and flowed freely, and it was all about Nicholas, and was a recalling of the life we had lived with him. And every now and then Sepi said, as if to himself, 12 days. Less than 12 days. We said we must be with him all the time. We must have all of him we could. The days were precious now. Yet we did not go to seek him. It would be like meeting the dead, and we were afraid. We did not say it, but that was what we were feeling. And so it gave us a shock when we turned a curve and came upon Nicholas face to face. He shouted, gaily, "Hi, hi! What is the matter? Have you seen a ghost?" We couldn't speak, but there was no occasion. He was willing to talk for us all, for he had just seen Satan, and was in high spirits about it. Satan had told him about our trip to China, and he had begged Satan to take him a journey, and Satan had promised. It was to be a far journey, and wonderful and beautiful, and Nicholas had begged him to take us too, but he said no, he would take us someday, maybe, but not now. Satan would come for him on the 13th, and Nicholas was already counting the hours, he was so impatient. That was the fatal day. We were already counting the hours too. We wandered many a mile, always following paths which had been our favorites from the days when we were little, and always we talked about the old times. All the blitheness was with Nicholas. We others could not shake off our depression. Our tone toward Nicholas was so strangely gentle and tender and yearning that he noticed it and was pleased, and we were constantly doing him deferential little offices of courtesy and saying, "Wait, let me do that for you," and that pleased him too. I gave him 7 fish hooks, all I had, and made him take them, and Seppi gave him his new knife and a humming top painted red and yellow atonements for swindles practiced upon him formerly, as I learned later, and probably no longer remembered by Nicholas now. These things touched him, and he could not have believed that we loved him so, and his pride in it and gratefulness for it cut us to the heart. We were so undeserving of them. When we parted at last, he was radiant and said he had never had such a happy day. As we walked along homeward, Sepi said, "We always prized him, but never so much as now, when we are going to lose him." Next day and every day we spent all of our spare time with Nicholas, and also added to a time which we and he stole from work and other duties, and this cost the 3 of us some sharp scoldings and some threats of punishment. Every morning 2 of us woke with a start and a shudder, saying, as the days flew along, "Only 10 days left, semicolon, only 9 days left, only 8, semicolon, only 7. Always it was narrowing. Always Nicholas was gay and happy, and always puzzled, because we were not. He wore his invention to the bone, trying to invent ways to cheer us up, but it was only a hollow success. He could see that our jollity had no heart in it, and that the laughs we broke into came up against some obstruction or other and suffered damage and decayed into a sigh. He tried to find out what the matter was, so that he could help us out of our trouble, or make it lighter, by sharing it with us. So we had to tell many lies to deceive him and appease him. But the most distressing thing of all was that he was always making plans, and often they went beyond the 13th. Whenever that happened, it made us groan in spirit. All his mind was fixed upon finding some way to conquer our depression and cheer us up. And at last, when he had but 3 days to live, he fell upon the right idea, and was jubilant over it. A boys and girls frolic and dance in the woods, up there where we first met Satan, and this was to occur on the 14th. It was ghastly, for that was his funeral day. We couldn't venture to protest. It would only have brought a high, which we could not answer. He wanted us to help him invite his guests, and we did it. One can refuse nothing to a dying friend. But it was dreadful, for really we were inviting them to his funeral. It was an awful 11 days, and yet, with a lifetime stretching back between today and then, they are still a grateful memory to me, and beautiful. In effect, they were days of companionship with one sacred dead, and I have known no comradeship that was so close or so precious. We clung to the hours and the minutes, counting them as they wasted away, and parting with them with that pain and bereavement which a miser feels who sees his hoard filched from him coin by robbers, and is helpless to prevent it. When the evening of the last day came, we stayed out too long. Seppi and I were in fault for that. We could not bear to part with Nicholas. So it was very late when we left him at his door. We lingered near while listening, and that happened which we were fearing. His father gave him the promised punishment, and we heard his shrieks. But we listened only a moment, then hurried away, remorseful for this thing which we had caused. And sorry for the father too, our thought being, if he only knew, if he only knew. In the morning Nicholas did not meet us at the appointed place, so we went to his home, to see what the matter was. His mother said, "His father is out of all patience with these goings on, and will not have any more of it. Half the time when Nick is needed he is not to be found. Then it turns out that he has been gadding around with you too. His father gave him a flogging last night. It always grieved me before, and many's the time I have begged him off and saved him, but this time he appealed to me in vain, for I was out of patience myself. I wish you had saved him just this one time," I said, my voice trembling a little. "It would ease a pain in your heart to remember it someday." She was ironing at the time, and her back was partly toward me. She turned about with a startled or wondering look in her face and said, "What do you mean by that?" I was not prepared, and didn't know anything to say, so it was awkward, for she kept looking at me, but Seppi was alert and spoke up. "Why, of course it would be pleasant to remember, for the very reason we were out so late was that Nicholas got to telling how good you are to him, and how he never got whipped when you were by to save him, and he was so full of it, and we were so full of the interest of it, that none of us noticed how late it was getting." "Did he say that? Did he?" And she put her apron to her eyes. "You can ask Theodore, he will tell you the same. It is a dear, good lad, my Nick," she said. "I'm sorry I let him get whipped. I will never do it again. To think all the time I was sitting here last night, fretting and angry at him, he was loving me and praising me. Dear, dear, if we could only know. Then we shouldn't ever go wrong, but we are only poor dumb beasts groping around and making mistakes. I shan't ever think of last night without a pang." She was like all the rest. It seemed as if nobody could open a mouth, in these wretched days, without saying something that made us shiver. They were groping around, and did not know what true, sorrowfully true things they were saying by accident. Seppi asked if Nicholas might go out with us. "I am sorry," she answered, "but he can't. To punish him further, his father doesn't allow him to go out of the house today." We had a great hope. I saw it in Seppi's eyes. We thought, if he cannot leave the house, he cannot be drowned. Seppi asked, "To make sure, must he stay in all day, or only the morning?" "All day. It's such a pity too. It's a beautiful day, and he is so unused to being shut up. But he is busy planning his party, and maybe that is company for him. I do hope he isn't too lonesome." Seppi saw that in her eye which emboldened him to ask if we might go up and help him pass his time. "And welcome," she said, right heartily. "How I call that real friendship, when you might be abroad in the fields and the woods, having a happy time. You are good boys, I'll allow that, though you don't always find satisfactory ways of improving it. Take these cakes for yourselves and give him this one, from his mother." The first thing we noticed when we entered Nicholas's room was the time 9:45. Could that be correct? Only such a few minutes to live. I felt a contraction at my heart. Nicholas jumped up and gave us a glad welcome. He was in good spirits over his plannings for his party and had not been lonesome. "Sit down," he said, "and look at what I've been doing. And I've finished a kite that you will say is a beauty. It's drying in the kitchen. I'll fetch it. He had been spending his penny savings in fanciful trifles of various kinds, to go as prizes in the games, and they were marshaled with fine and showy effect upon the table. He said, "Examine them at your leisure, while I get mother to touch up the kite with her iron, if it isn't dry enough yet." Then he tripped out, and went clattering downstairs, whistling. We did not look at the things. We couldn't take any interest in anything but the clock. We sat staring at it in silence, listening to the ticking, and every time the minute hand jumped we nodded recognition 1 minute fewer to cover in the race for life or for death. Finally Seppi drew a deep breath and said, 2:50. 7 minutes more, and he will pass the death point. Theater, he is going to be saved. He's going to, hush. I'm on needles. Watch the clock and keep still. 5 minutes more. We were panting with the strain and the excitement. Another 3 minutes, and there was a footstep on the stair. Saved. And we jumped up, and faced the door. The old mother entered, bringing the kite. SN'T it a beauty? She said. ND, dear me, how he has slaved over it ever since daylight, I think, and only finished it a while before you came. She stood it against the wall, and stepped back to take a view of it. He drew the pictures his own self, and I think they are very good. The church isn't so very good, I'll have to admit, but look at the bridge. Anyone can recognize the bridge in a minute. He asked me to bring it up, dear me. It's 10:07, and but where is he? He? Oh, he'll be here soon. He's gone out a minute. Gone out? Yes. Just as he came downstairs, little Lisa's mother came in, and said the child had wandered off somewhere, and as she was a little uneasy I told Nicholas, to never mind about his father's orders, go and look her up. Why, how white you two do look. I do believe you are sick. Sit down, I'll fetch something. That cake has disagreed with you. It is a little heavy, but I thought she disappeared without finishing her sentence, and we hurried at once to the back window and looked toward the river. There was a great crowd at the other end of the bridge, and people were flying toward that point from every direction. Oh, it is all over, poor Nicholas. Why, oh, why did she let him get out of the house? Come away, said Seppi, half sobbing. Come quick, we can't bear to meet her. In 5 minutes she will know. But we were not to escape. She came upon us at the foot of the stairs, with her cordials in her hands, and made us come in, and sit down and take the medicine. Then she watched the effect, and it did not satisfy her, so she made us wait longer, and kept upbraiding herself for giving us the unwholesome cake. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.